Interesting guest tonight, and we'd like to welcome him to the show right now. On the line with us tonight for the first hour, we have Dr. Bruce Cornett, who lives in Red Bank, New Jersey, I believe. Dr. Bruce, how are you?
Fine, thank you, sir.
It's always good to talk to someone. You know, Larry Dickin, who produces this show, is a fellow New Jerseyan. And so it's always nice to talk to somebody that's at least a neighbor, a part of our program. You know, we've got a lot of things to talk about here tonight, and one of the things I really wanted to get into before we did anything else is talk to you about this SETV program.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, you developed this back in 1998 with a fellow by the name of Scott Stride.
Yes.
Yeah. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit what this is all about?
Well, SETV is basically an offshoot from SETI. It stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Visitation. And it's a bold move, basically designed to look for near-Earth ET robotic probes. Ever since NASA has become very effective in sending man-made probes to other planets within our solar system, it's become very obvious to scientists that this is perhaps the best way to explore space rather than sending astronauts out. And that if it's so effective, as it has been for NASA, why wouldn't ET be doing the same thing? And nobody has looked for this for ET probes.
Yeah, that is an interesting approach. So in other words, if I'm reading between the lines here, you're saying that maybe some of these UFO sightings we have may not be anything other than robotic probes similar to our Mars missions.
Yes, but probably much more sophisticated. I mean, if we're talking about ET civilizations that are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ahead of us, their probes would probably be have artificial intelligence within them, and even robots, and maybe even robots that would be capable of reproducing themselves, and give the impression of being a humanoid or something of this nature. Maybe.
Well, and that would certainly fit into a lot of the descriptions of some of these encounters that people have had over the. Well, I've been doing UFO shows since 1987, and it would certainly kind of fit that description, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And the whole object is to design technology using the technology that is currently available, and we're living at a very on the cusp of major developments in technology, and a lot of this has become available off the shelf, as they call it, the COTS, commercial off the shelf technology.
So in other words, we could use what's available now and actually do this fairly cheaply.
Yes, for example, in the past, people, in order to take movies of things in the sky, they would have to use 8-millimeter cameras and or something of that nature, or very bulky video camera equipment. Now we have the pocket camcorders, virtually, that people can buy for under $400 and go out and capture something in the sky that's much better data than just a person's description of what they saw.
We are talking with Dr. Bruce Cornett here on the line from New Jersey, and it's okay if I call you Bruce, right?
Yes.
Okay, Bruce, I notice AOP a lot of times by your name, and I finally figured out what that is. That's an anomalistic observational phenomena, right?
Yes.
What is that?
That is a term that was coined by Baker back in the late 60s, also endorsed by Carl Sagan. It essentially, the problem has become that UFO has become, in the public's mind, synonymous with ET or extraterrestrial spacecraft. And most of the things that we see in the sky, we do not have enough information about them to be able to determine what it is, let alone where it came from. And part of SETI is to build instrument platforms that we put out into the field that are autonomous, that do a full range of scientific experiments and observation and collect data on things that are flying around in our atmosphere. And also using artificial, what intelligence or computer intelligence we have, would be able to analyze things in the sky. And if something based on various instruments did not match what we can identify, then it would start recording on a whole series of bandwidths of different kinds of sensors and store that data and then eventually transmit it via satellite to a central computer where it would be analyzed by various scientists.
Now, I was talking to Larry Dickin, our producer for the show, a little earlier on the air. In the air, we were plugging what we were going to do tonight, and he mentioned that you plan to do this in an unobtrusive way. In other words, you don't plan to use radar or something that they could catch on what we were doing.
That's right. It would be a stealth type of a piece of equipment, basically because we do not want to influence the data by creating a situation whereby we can't first have an objective look at what's there. And that's also one of the reasons why, at least in the initial parts of any experiment, no human observers would be used, because many times humans will introduce factors of bias that will then change the way the data is.
I understand, in the interpretation itself.
Yes.
And so you feel that you can get around that problem.
And we've gotten to the point right now where the technology is so good and the capability of putting things together like this has been done already with our probes to Mars, for example, that we can, if we put these platforms out that can be full scan of the sky, and we'd be putting them in different parts of the world and testing different theories. Now, because humans have generally been the recorders in the past for sightings of what I call AOP, obviously there would have to be a human present in order to have a sighting, correct?
Correct. Makes sense to me.
And so there's certain bias right there. We don't know, maybe robotic probes are out there studying certain minerals, looking for certain resources in certain areas of the world where, and they want to stay away from humans. They've already found out that that's not where to look for the things they want.
Uh-huh. Now, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Burnett here, and we're talking about a general range of subjects tonight on the UFO files. And one thing I really want to kind of bring up with the audience here right away. And get your answer, but I understand you have had contact with something, someplace.
Yes, I've had quite a few of the traditional classic experiences that range the entire gamut, but as a scientist, I recognize that the information that I have, most of it that was done personally to me, is personal. It's an anecdotal. I can't prove what happened. I can tell you what happened. I can tell you what I think it might represent. But is that proof? That's not even close. I started an investigation in the area of Pine Bush, New York. That's in Orange County, New York, back in 1992. I was living actually about 10 miles from Pine Bush at the time.
In fact, our listeners are pretty familiar with Pine Bush over the years simply because there's been a lot of sightings up there.
There's a tremendous amount of activity has been there in the past. And this was a great opportunity for me after work to go out into the field, and I had access to various types of instruments and to try to check it out. And being a geologist, one of the things I wanted to do is find out what was unique about that area. I was introduced to a book by Ellen Crystal called Silent Invasion. She had done a 10-year study and on this particular pine bush phenomenon, and when I came across her book, I was rather surprised that her area of interest was in my backyard. So I contacted her, and she took me out into the field with her, and I started seeing many of the same things and recording many of the same things that she had described in her book.
Now, you might tell our audience, I've never been to Pine Bush. I take it it's a small town in the hills of New York, or what?
Yes, it's actually, the area has a number of small towns forming sort of encircling the hot spot, if you can call it that. To the north is Pine Bush, to the west is Pine Bush, to the north is Wallkill, to the east is Walden, and to the south is Montgomery. All these are small little hamlets, I mean really small towns, and they all have had people living there that have had sightings. I mean the whole area is is known for this.
I read someplace, and maybe you would know more about this. Maybe you could verify this for me or tell me I'm just full of it, but I hear about half the population has seen things.
Oh, yeah. No doubt at all. I've gotten to know quite a few people up there. Many times people won't want to talk about it, especially people living right next to the hot spot. How would you like to be living, have a house, and right out your back door, all of these strange things were happening?
Yeah. In other words, that might do something to the real estate values.
Exactly. So they keep it hush-hush, right.
I mean, you'd have to get a really pretty real estate woman to sell your property. You know what I mean?
Well, one of the things that the locals have done, which is rather interesting, I don't know if this was intentionally done, but because the area has become almost a bedroom community for New York and commuters, the real estate developers have gone out of their way to develop the land where all of these sightings occur. So now there's a whole residential community there living right on the property where I have my cameras and recorders and instruments have recorded things that are just outrageous.
Well, now, even before you used the term outrageous, Dr. Cornett, I was going to have to ask you for a little more detail on something.
Oh, okay. All right. To give you a little bit of an idea, indeed, there are going to be some people in your audience who are going to think, oh, this has got to be the military. Nobody would be able to do this way except, if it was just somebody who's trying to pull a big joke. Ellen wanted to invite the sightings television crew out because she was being interviewed and she wanted me to be interviewed. And we went out to an area on West Searsville Road where we had gone many, many times, and one of the areas where I have collected most of my data. And when the television crew showed up, a whole bunch of craft came and put on performances for the camera. Huge craft. A diamond-shaped craft, triangular-shaped craft.
Yeah, you're saying that the sightings crew shows up and they do for lack of a better term, a show for them.
Exactly. And this was quite, it blew everybody away to the extent that they were unprepared and only a little bit of that ever got put onto television, largely because it was, as I said, so outrageous. How would you like to have a series of craft that are the size of small jetliners and large jetliners lined up in the sky, hovering, waiting for their turn to come at the cameras, turn in front of the cameras, turn on their side, travel sideways, upside down, backwards, and then go back and disappear behind the trees.
Just like a military air show.
Yeah.
Only this wasn't the military, you don't think?
Well, as you said, skeptics are going to say, oh, it has to have been, and yet you see that they all was all plasma-based instead of lamps, and they were able to defy gravity and do right angle turns. I took a series of time exposures, and I have them doing literal right angle turns, like almost stair step, as they're moving along at a fairly good clip. And if this is the military, okay, and I'm not saying that it isn't, but if it is, there are some very serious questions that need to be raised. Number one, just how far ahead is our technology? Because what we witnessed and what I was able to record on my various instruments indicate that this stuff is capable of defying gravity and a number of other things. Also, why would they put on a show for television cameras? The military, this is not part of the military mindset. The military operates in secrecy. And they're top secret aircraft. They keep out in secret air bases, like out in Area 51. They don't go putting on air shows for the public.
Yeah, you got a good point there, Dr. Cornett. What about the sightings crew? What did they say?
They were basically in a state of shock and denial based on their reaction. They didn't know what to say. What the heck was that? Oh, my God. They couldn't recognize these things. And but this is where SETV comes in. You see, even with all of these witnesses, all of these cameras, all of this recording data, right, we still couldn't be certain of what we actually saw. And part of the reason for the SETV experiment is to collect additional data. Now, one of the things the scientists like to do is that If a certain kinds of data do not give you the answer, they want to look at other kinds of data from that give you another perspective on what is going on. For example, an optical spectral radiometer. Now that may sound like a complicated name, but it's an instrument that breaks down and analyzes light to its individual components and can identify the sources of the light. In other words, what kinds of atoms are excited to make that light, okay? Now, if you take that instrument and you shine it at an aircraft light, and a lamp on an aircraft, one of the things you'll see is a spike for tungsten, because the lights will have a tungsten filament in it, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you were to shine a light at something flying in the sky, and you didn't get tungsten, but you got some other weird elements, instead, recorded, this would be
a different kind of light.
Different kind of light, and one of the things that happened to me out there is that I would go back out into the field time and time again over a period of about 5 years. I did a huge magnetic survey, a geologic survey, to try to check things out on the ground, and I also have recorded hundreds of sightings. And many of these things, Jerry, these craft actually put on performances for my camera. They came to me, and I would take a series of time exposures in order to capture their movement in the sky. And when I started looking at these time exposures after the prints came back, I realized that they formed patterns, and I started splicing the pictures together. And lo and behold, they were creating sky glyphs, movements in the night sky that took on shapes of various things, such as the giant letter S. This was one of their very familiar things. And other times they would project holographic images.
That's pretty amazing right there. What kind of images?
Well, one time I was photographing what appeared to be a set of plasma lights moving along, the plasma beaming that it's excited gaseous energy rather than a light bulb, and all of a sudden, as it passes in front of me at a distance, there was a flash of light coming out of the ground at a distance near the where these lights were, and when the picture came back, it illuminated an image of a giant pyramid.
Wow. Now, the interesting thing about, that, of course, is, in ufology, pyramids have lots of significance.
You got it. In another case, a similar sort of thing happened, and this time this craft shot a light across the sky, sort of a splay of green light, and it illuminated or created an image of a Greek temple.
Now, do you think they were sending messages or
symbolic messages? Yes,
mm-hmm.
They're sort of like clues. In other words,
they're having fun with you.
Yeah. They were definitely playing with my mind. There's no question about that. But they were also giving me data. One of the pieces of data they gave me, which was quite important, is one of the common craft out there. I call it the manta ray because it was shaped like that of the marine animal.
Uh-huh.
And even had a tail. It has a tail like that of a manta ray. And this craft came at us, and as it was approaching us, I was taking a series of time exposures while Ellen Crystal was videotaping it. So we got the whole range of kinds of images on this, and it had two huge bright lights that are sort of like headlights, but they weren't landing lights, and it started causing one to break up, flutter, okay? When I got the time exposures back, you can actually see the light breaking up into plasma balls. And clearly identified. I've had plasma physicists look at them and said, that's a plasma. So right there, they gave me some information that indicated that this was not a lamp.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about robotic probes.
Mm-hmm.
These things probably weren't robotic, or do you think they were?
Well, they
or do you know?
We don't know. We don't have enough information. See, one of the interesting things that I've asked myself many questions of why. Why me? What was special about the situation? And yet I would keep on coming back, whereas many other people wouldn't. And I was very patient, wanting to collect more data, and they seemed to be feeding me certain amounts of data that for me to study. And I would go take the data home, the pictures and the recordings, and analyze them. And I would find things that were quite amazing. In other words, I got a pretty good idea of the craft capability. Now, did they have pilots, living biological entities? I don't know, because we just do not have enough information. And that's where SETI comes in. So if we had had these stealth or low observable platforms out in the field, recording data on these objects as they were flying around, putting on these performances, can you imagine how much more we would know about them and be able to eliminate certain possibilities?
Now, how far along is this project, SETV, SETI? The first thing I think about is funding. How are you going to pull that off?
We've been looking for funding, various sources, and the biggest problem, of course, is that we're up against a wall of bias, if you can say, that not so much that our colleagues in science are unwilling to support us, because we're seeing a shift. Even within members of SETI, we took a poll of SETI members recently, and Scott did a very detailed a list of a questionnaire for members in SETI and got back amazing responses that we quite frankly did not expect, where most of the people in SETI, despite the fact that they say they're looking for extraterrestrial life way out in space, actually think that it may be here already studying us.
No.
And yet, to get funding, now we have to basically find people who are willing to take that step. And so long as this subject creates a level of uncomfortableness among people in our society, which it has for quite some time, ever since there's been all of this negative information coming out about UFOs, essentially we have not gotten the funding we want, but we're still very hopeful that
now, how does someone, do you have a website? I know we have some links to several things to you. I what's the best way for somebody listening that would like to follow up on this project? I mean, you never know who's listening.
Well, if they go to this particular website, which was designed by Scott Stride, they can get some more information on the organization that we have. It's www.interstellar-probes.org.
Interstellar-probes.
.org. Interstellar-probes.
Okay, I want to make sure we get this right, because as you know, you get one thing wrong, you get it all screwed up. It's interstellar, it's spelled the normal way, -probes.org.
Yes.
Dr. Bruce Cornett is our guest. We're going to take a break here.